taste of cream. Red roses too. I see them bloom.
This is Ed Cohen, your editor of Global Business News and the host today on GlobalRadioTalkShow.com. Well, we're coming to you today from San Diego and also Washington, D.C. I'd like to just introduce Global Business News. You know, it's in our DNA to bring business people together from across time zones and cultures, from across borders, to connect, learn, and collaborate. We do that online, live, and in print. The C-suite, CEO and CMO and CHRO, have objectives that include adapting their locally based people and organizations to grow the global mindset in order to better understand their diverse global talent and their global customers. And they do this in order to build and market more useful products. So that's what Global Business News is all about. Bring people together for conversations, to share ideas, to exchange techniques for the common good. Our special guest today is Elena Anderson-DeLay, who's Director of Global Mobility and Visa Services at the well-known Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Let's welcome Elaine.
Hi, Ed. Thanks for having me today.
And looking forward to you speaking again at our National Press Club conference on October 27th. So I wanted to ask you about Brookings Institution. Describe it briefly. What is it?
Well, the Brookings Institution, we're nearing our 100th year of existence. We are a policy research organization based in Washington, D.C., with presence in Beijing, China, Doha, Qatar, and New Delhi, India.
Interesting. And so it's a think tank. And is it about public policy, or is it about how to run their country better? You know, what's it about?
Yes, it is about public policy, as such as tax reform, governance. We have both a domestic U.S. focus with our cities, as well as with various political changes. But we have a very vast and broad global focus, whether it's education policy or the governance of other nations or the relations between nations or regions of nations.
So the people that you employ, that the Brookings Institution employs, not only in the U.S. but internationally, would these be economists or would these be academics or what else?
You're correct. Actually, economists and academics are only a portion of our experts that we bring from around the world. We have former members of government. We have former members of international ministerial staff. We have consultants, business leaders. We have military leaders that spend time with us. We also have up-and-coming potential new academics and specialists and experts overarching several disciplines.
What's the population of the Brookings Institution? It probably varies from time to time, over and above a hard core of employees. But what are we talking about here in size of the company, of the organization?
That's a great question, Ed. Actually, in looking at our traditional employees, we're close to 500 employees, both full-time and part-time, worldwide. However, we have affiliated guests, which range from our junior interns participating in internship programs, to visiting fellows, to distinguished fellows who come and participate in a structured fellowship program or independent research. Within that broader community, we have over 300 individuals. So when we refer to the Brookings community overall, we're close to 800 individuals that majority of them are physically in the Washington, D.C. area, but others are in different parts of the U.S. and in different parts of the world, as well as some of our international centers abroad.
Is it fair for me to say that Brookings Institution is not political, although there may be some political issues that impact policy development and white papers? it's really not a political organization. It's not a lobbying group, is it?
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, we have a very strong anti-lobbying, nonpartisan culture here. We try to recruit when there's a topic or issue that we're focusing on. We make every effort to recruit experts from both sides. And when it comes to, let's say, U.S. politics, we definitely focus on that. Our goal is to not only have quality research, but have an impact, but to maintain our independence. So our slogan is QII, quality, impact, independence. We have quality information that we hope can impact the decision makers in making a very unbiased decision that is not partial to any party or another. It's definitely from the background and culture of an academic. So we have a very strong academic culture, and we maintain that through these 100 years.
Would you say that the executives of the Brookings Institution understand the need to shift talent across borders around the world?
Absolutely. We recognize that it's not just the breadth of information and topics and issues that we need to focus on, but the depth. And when we refer to ourselves as a global think tank, we take that seriously. So we do not see it as a downside to have some of our domestic employees travel or to bring in experts from outside of the U.S. or from one country to another, because we want to bring talent together to create that impact that would produce the best research needed for the decision makers of today.
And so the research drives the type of people that might be asked to relocate. So what kind of research is typical? For instance, is it about how to make a change in the culture of an organization or a country, or to develop a program connected with that kind of change? Something like that?
Very similar. In fact, even much more than that, Ed. You mentioned that whether or not we bring in economists, not only do we bring in economists, but we also bring in organizational experts, some medical experts to address it, medical policy, educators to address education policy on a local, global level, whether it's the U.S. or non-U.S. And as they are coming in, we really hone in on some of their backgrounds and expertise to either help us dig deeper into an issue or to challenge some of our own findings and find that it's better. So we don't necessarily do research for hire. We do research for the public good.
Okay, now let's drill down a little bit to this program called Mobility Management. So when the bosses say, well, we need to have feet on the ground here, eyes on the ground to look at certain situations, you know, connected with our advice giving, our research gathering, so then the mobility package comes into play. So I assume that you don't have a large volume of people on the move, but you probably have different kinds of packages. Is that correct?
That's correct. In fact, many of them we don't refer to as packages. We refer to them, they may be even smaller transactions from the traditional mobility sense. But we're definitely flexible, and we approach global mobility in a different way than what the industry traditionally labels as mobility.
Like, what do you mean by that? What's different?
I would say that it's a more comprehensive look. It's not just about the movement or the logistics and getting that individual from country A to country B or point A to point B. It's about the comprehensive nature of doing that. And so a lot of my job involves working across disciplines and silos and stakeholders from various realms of expertise, whether it's personnel to finance to even learning a bit more about risk management so that we can have a successful transition for the individual. our transitions really could be a matter of a few weeks to several years, and we adapt accordingly to the business need of that time.
So what would be the risk? What are some of the risks to this kind of a situation? I mean, we're not talking about physical risks. What kind of risks are we talking about?
Could be natural disaster risk, things beyond our control that are totally external. It could be political risk. There could also be a risk to our brand if the individual is not fulfilling the service that they've been retained to do. So it's a varying, depending on the period of time and the nature of the services that will be provided. All that is taken into account, that we think things through and we work collaboratively in order to have logistical success, but also success in the product that the individual will help produce.
So to what extent are families asked to move?
Family really changes the dynamic of logistics, and you really look at the family unit, and it's a very big decision. When we are addressing family, there is we take a slower pace and really look at the dynamic. We do have a lot of individuals who decide to travel as individuals, and then their families will rejoin them. And I make sure to have that conversation to see where they are mentally, emotionally with their transition. So it's not just about work permits, scheduling flights, moving household goods. It's about making sure that when our colleagues arrive in their location, that they are ready to be productive. They're not distracted by worrying about family if their family decides to join them at the same time that everything is settled. Because when the family is settled and happy, or comfortable at least, then you're going to have a much more productive colleague and peer.
So we're talking about consulting, looking into how a situation can be rectified or mitigated in order to create a better assimilation or an integration into the new community, and to be helpful to people rather than be more harsh. How much effort do you guys invest in on the ground? Once the relocation occurs, that's when all the trouble begins. It's not before. It's the assimilation and the integration and the psychological adaptation, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, it's interesting that you reference consulting. I refer to it as being both not just a consultant, but an advisor at times, but also a concierge. We do have a policy that determines our budgeting structure. However, we use that as the guardrails for budgeting, since a lot of our funds for supporting mobility is sourced by our funders or related to a specific project. However, we still look at it as the individual, and I won't take credit for providing all the support. I do have to give credit to my colleagues within the centers, within the departments, that as they're recruiting the talent, they immediately take note of some of the needs, some of the requests given by the talent that they may bring up as priorities to make sure that they are onboarded successfully. So it could be something as simple as making sure a piano is shipped because the colleague's stress relief is through playing the piano. Even though that's something expensive to do, we're going to make every effort to do that. And it could be a colleague that has a child that they want to ensure that the child maintains a certain language competency. So having knowledge of area schools that speak French or have immersion programs in certain languages is helpful. So from the concierge perspective, I become very well integrated in Washington, D.C. and learn all the resources available. But as a consultant or an advisor, I engage my stakeholders in those departments and programs and let them know that maybe more budget support is needed or more time is needed to ensure that their transition is as smooth as possible. I never treat everyone the same way. Everyone is unique, as we are as human beings. And even if we are relocating the same person years later, their situation is never identical as before. So we start off with a clean slate and ensure that we talk about the whole person, not just this expert or talent that is arriving by a certain date.
Let's drill down here as we need to come to a close in a couple of minutes, but I really want you to address how you scope out a provider, a service provider, you know, considering the needs that you just addressed. There's some very, very special service providers that are required then, not so much for delivering ABC of product or service, but the type of people that you will demand to have that service delivery performed by.
We do have the traditional request for proposal process, but in that we do give a little bit of background about the organization, the type of talent that we bring in. We do have a very detailed RFP, a very detailed process that we look at potential suppliers and partners for. And once we find that finalist, I do spend an extensive amount of time to explain the number of stakeholders that I have and the number of people, because I consider us to be low volume. And in the traditional industry of global mobility, we don't relocate that much, but the people that we relocate, we make a lot of effort to make sure that it's a smooth process and we look at the whole individual. We can't, as a nonprofit research organization, we don't have money to throw around, and we are accountable for the money that we do engage. Therefore, we can't just lump sum everything. We can't just throw money at the problem. We make it a people service. And in doing that, I have to have partners that are willing to at least assign to us a representative, a contact that can do that capacity. And it's a relationship that's established. We don't expect the first two experiences to be smooth, but we do expect a high touch, high level of support, because we are very slim staffed, or we don't have like deep capacity to support all of the logistics. But we do really care about the transition, because if someone burns out due to their inability to transition properly, we take a tremendous loss at that. We've now lost expertise. We've lost potentially someone to a competing research organization, and it could damage our brand overall. We make every effort to make it happen, and I pass on that information to potential suppliers.
We're talking with Elena Anderson-DeLay, Director, Global Mobility and Visa Services at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. So, Elena, I thank you very much for being a resource and, frankly, an inspiration about how to do it right and how to care for your people. So thanks very much.
My pleasure, Ed. Thanks for having me.
All right, this is Ed Cohen, editor of GlobalBusinessNews.net, and your host today on GlobalRadioTalkShow.com, signing off today from San Diego as well as Washington, D.C.
Yes, I think to myself.